This is an interview with Paul Konkin. You've already talked about your own work and research, and thought I'd give you a chance today as a departing member of the department to talk about the department since 1967 when you came, and how you feel about it, some of the developments, some of the issues. Would you start first by saying why you came here?
Well, that was hard for me at the time. It's always hard for me to know why I make decisions. I was at the University of Maryland. I had an attractive offer at Wisconsin, better salary, and I knew that it traditionally had been a larger and more prestigious department, one of the best in, particularly in American history, my field. But I had a hard time making a decision, and I think typically I can't even place my finger on when I finally decided to come to Wisconsin. It was a day by day. One day I was going to stay in Maryland and the next day come to Wisconsin.
You were, Paul Glad was the one who initiated the offer, was he?
Well, I think Paul Glad perhaps put my name in as a candidate for the position. Mm. I'd been a colleague of his until the year before, and he came, and that certainly had something to do, I think, with my decision, knowing someone as well as I knew Paul Glad and having a friendly face in a new department. I think that's important. He was not, as far as I remember, on the search committee and did not have a direct role mm-hmm. in the hiring. But that's then, I suppose, and I think it's still true, that Wisconsin is one of the five or six major graduate departments in the field of history, and particularly traditionally had been in the field of American history. I think today it may be a bit stronger in other fields than in American history, but it did not appear to me that way when I came. And I was coming to a department in a field that had that developed more here than anywhere else under Merle Curdy, intellectual history. And Merle Curdy was on the verge of retirement, and that was the reason for the appointment. Mm-hmm. So that was an important factor, too.
That was rather a devastating comment. It may be a bit stronger in other fields than it is in American history.
Well, we've had severe losses the last few years in American history. In fact, a series of them, it goes all the way back to the time that Bill Taylor left and Curdy retired. We've been unable, except in one case, to make advanced appointments. And the one we did make, Berkhofer, we lost because he went to Michigan. So in a sense, we've been appointing very able younger people in the department, but I don't think that we have been able to maintain the same profile that we had when I came. Mm-hmm. That is, with outstanding scholars, recognized scholars in several fields. Merle Jensen, for example, retired, mm-hmm. and that hurt.
And let's see, and Paul Glad left.
Well, Paul Glad left, several able younger people left. Pauline Meyer came for a year and left, and the chair that we have for a woman historian. We've had difficulty both in getting money for recruitment and particularly in getting funds for any senior appointments. Mm-hmm. I think the young people are very able, and many of them have great promise. It's just that they have not developed the stature in the profession that they will later. We're not as visible because of preeminent people in several fields.
You said the other day that, in fact, you ought to leave a university after about 5 years.
Well, I didn't say 5 years. I think that varies. What I argued is that a strong department will have people leaving because they'll have people who are in great demand in other universities. If they don't have people leaving, it's a danger sign. And often, I think the people make their greatest contribution to a university in the first part of their tenure, perhaps the first 10 years when they're in a university. And if you can replace people who leave by equally able people, the department may gain from the new blood, new points of view. So there's nothing wrong with turnover if you can maintain the same quality of staff.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you came in 1967, what were the major issues in the department?
Well, it's hard for me to recall little things. there had been a committee for several years trying to develop a more objective technique for selecting teaching assistants, chaired by John Harrison, who's also long since left the department. Well, this matured plan came to a vote in one of the first department meetings. We had them, I think, every 2 weeks, luncheon meetings then. Came to a vote in one of the earliest department meetings when I was here, and not understanding the backdrop to it and finding it a rather, from my standpoint, too bureaucratic, I was a lone dissenting vote against what became famous in the department as the Harrison scale, a technique for selecting teaching assistants and also rules for qualifying for other types of fellowships. I suppose that was a big issue, but even before that first year was over, the campus violence erupted and university policies invaded the department. And such enormous issues as whether our department meetings should be open or not for students occupied us for the next 2 or 3 years, often in bitter debate that went on hours and hours, dividing us a bit against each other, although the department never fell into deep divisions.
You say major, you're being sarcastic,
I'm being facetious,
obviously.
Indeed, because in many cases the things we fought hardest about turned out to be of no consequence once we resolved them. Eventually, a judicial decision forced us to open our department meetings, and nothing happened. In fact, when students gained the right to come to our faculty meetings, they did what is very predictable. They found out how boring they were, and none came anyway. So over and over again, the issues turned out to be trivial, but at the time we were debating them, they seemed to touch faculty members at a very sensitive point, and they divided on political, ideological grounds.
Well, you've just been reading Phil Curtin's interview with Donna Taylor a few years ago, but when he left, and he was very concerned about opening having the history department have courses covering the whole globe. Did you have an opinion on that, or was it already settled?
Well, we had strong programs in third world areas, as we mm-hmm. call it. When I came, Phil Curtin is one that had a lot to do with building those.
Yeah.
And when I came just a couple of years before, I think we divided into three caucuses, giving the third world one of the caucuses. So it was equal and had very strong people in it. That battle was over, and I thought it was great when I came that we had that strength. Mm-hmm. In fact, very few departments in the country even yet have as much strength in as many areas of the third world.
So you're in favor of that?
Of course. Yes. Again, if there's a period of declining members of the faculty, you have to make hard decisions today about whether you can maintain all of those programs. It's often pointless, I suspect, to have a program in South Asia and have only one person. If we're going to have good programs, we have to have a minimum of two or possibly three staff members. Mm-hmm. And if enrollments are very low, it's awfully hard to get legislative support or funds for maintaining prestige appointments when there's only a few students. What Phil Curtin had going for him back then was the avalanche of students in the 60s, particularly graduate students. So at the graduate level, at least, third world courses were full. A lot of graduate students going through the mill. That's often not true today, so there are problems.
Mm-hmm. He spoke of the possibility of a comparative American-European history course. Were you in on that?
They did a comparative tropical history program, and later they expanded it. It still goes on, I think probably with something less than the full support that Curtin gave it, but there's a comparative world history program today. Mm. And it involves historians from all areas who want to participate and who want their students to take courses in a comparative setting. I've been attending the committee this year, for example, on comparative world history.
But not, he spoke in this interview, he specifically said that there might be a comparative American-European history course.
We've never had such.
Did you ever yourself think about such a thing? Or?
Well, there'd have to be a comparative European-American course on given topics. I assume that it's difficult enough to try to teach Western Civ without our world history at the very beginning level. And in a sense, I suppose those courses are comparative to begin with. But I suppose what he had in mind is in given topical areas, such as intellectual history, to have comparative mm-hmm. courses, probably with two staff members teaching it. We've had conversations about that in several areas. Bob Kingdon and I have talked several times about a course on Calvinism in Europe and America. Mm-hmm. We never got it set up. We've always been enthusiastic about the idea.
Because you had too much else to do.
Partly that, and partly because we didn't have any course number to stick it under, and we'd have had to work that out. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes a good bit of administrative headaches in order to get a course in the catalog and to get it taught. It often intimidates people like us from going ahead with a good idea.
Oh.
It can. And then there are internal departmental problems about which credit will graduate students get if they take the course. Will it count for American credit, European credit? We've been a little too much segmented because of our caucus plan of organization and because of the very size of our graduate program. In American history, at least, we've tended to have our students take all their work in American history simply because we have such a wealth of offerings that they could do so. And I think that's cut them off from contact with other fields to their disadvantage. But that's changing. We don't have as many students or as many courses, and I think it's going to be much easier in the future to have them take some European history, at least, as part of a graduate program in American history. Always they had the possibility of an internal minor in other areas of history. But to take that meant it precluded them taking courses in other departments, and I'm not sure there's anything gained by that.
Struggle between the innovators and the conservatives.
I haven't. That's Curtin's
yeah,
phrase, no. Or his perception. I either came too late or was politically too innocent to ever pick up this division in the department. My observation has been that it depends on issues, that there's shifting alignments on different issues, and at times people who are in favor of innovation in one area are opposed in another. It would be impossible for me to identify conservatives and versus innovators in the department in the last 12 years.
Including yourself?
Well, it'd be hard for me to classify myself because in certain areas I know I have probably fought for retention of existing standards and grades, for example. I've probably been more leery than many people about certain new course proposals or ask at least more questions about them before I would vote for them. In that sense, I might be perceived by others as one opposed to innovation. In other areas, I think I've been open. It depends. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably true of most of my colleagues, that you'd have to look at particular issues before you try to classify them, which only indicates, I think, the uselessness of such classifications.
Yes, obviously Phil was very much on a particular issue, and in that particular one, there definitely were the...
Well, he fought a battle. He created, as he stresses, antagonists, if not enemies. I don't think they were really enemies, but antagonists on educational policy. And he fought long and at times almost bitterly for certain goals. So it's easy from that perspective to come up with rather neat division among the staff.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't been in his position and have not sensed that type of division on any issue that I was very much involved in.
Have you had anything issue that you have fought for yourself?
Not unsuccessfully. I've been involved in two or three different revisions of our graduate program, and I haven't gotten all I wanted, but in most cases, I've been able to. I was on the committee just after I came here that made a very drastic change in the American graduate program, and to the despair of people like Merrill Jensen, for example, who never quite accepted our revisions and really, insofar as possible, refused to teach graduate students from that point on. So he felt deeply about it because he was part of the older system. When I came here, Wisconsin was probably the only department in the country that had basically, at least in American history, an apprenticeship type of program. A person came to graduate school by getting admission to one of the seminars offered by an individual professor. That is, the individual did the admitting to an extent, it's still true in European history. And they made that seminar of their major professor their home, usually until they completed their work, registering in it year after year, taking other people's courses, but very much identifying themselves as the student of the master. Mm-hmm. It's an apprenticeship type of program. Now, I don't know of any other place that's maintained it except Wisconsin. Increasingly, it seemed a program that did not work well in American history. We had then almost 30 staff members in American history. By each person having his own seminar, we were flooded with too many graduate students because they were inclined each year to accept enough students to keep a respectable seminar of 8 or 10 people. Multiply 30 professors by 8 or 10 people in a seminar and you see where the enrollment goes. In fact, it was a disgrace. We had about 300 graduate students in American history when I came. We were easily 1.5, perhaps 2 times larger in our program than any other university in the country.
Which means you were overextending yourselves as
much,
far as the work you could do.
Much. Overextending ourselves and the number of students, and I think equally important, we were often relaxing normal admission standards in order to get students into a given mm-hmm. seminar. Mm-hmm. In fact, in some seminars, it was notorious that almost anyone could get admitted. They could apply directly to the professor, and if he needed students in, they came. No rigor in the screening process. So we, a committee of 5, I was on it as an outsider. I didn't realize at the time the feelings within the department. So I operated again in political innocence. I probably act best in that innocent position. And I helped in the maturing of what has been our program ever since, that we admit as a caucus collectively with a committee to screen candidates. We don't have them commit themselves to a given topic or area or professor during the first year. And we offer a series of topical seminars and pro-seminars variously offered by individuals, and they choose among those. Mm-hmm. Only when they get to the second year in prelims do they really choose a topical area and a major professor. This opened things up in a different sort of way entirely. It meant that some students in the past who had been a bit confined to a given professor, it was very embarrassing for them to ask to change once they were here.
Yeah.
And unhappy students, rather than risking all the problems that come with coming to their major professor and saying, I want to move to someone else, had unhappily stayed in a seminar that did not really please them. Well, we opened it up and gave them much more leeway for choosing and for changing their mind after they got here, mm-hmm. and also drastically curtailed enrollment. Within 2 or 3 years, we had more than half the number of incoming graduate students. Well, I think the changes were desirable, long overdue. But as I say, a few of the old timers who were used to the older system were unhappy with it. They were unhappy with other aspects of the program, and I'm inclined to agree with them on some. We relaxed the standard requirement that everyone had to write an MA thesis.
I was going to ask you that because Dave Cronin felt very strongly about that.
That I was on the committee and I went along with that, but I was apprehensive about that change myself, and I think it was a mistake in retrospect. Although I was then at the time, I was quite willing to give it a try.
Is there any move to start it again?
Right. We've talked about it, and we have in fact tightened up the requirement in the last year, making it more appealing for students to take the thesis option, mm-hmm. because they'll have to take 3 semesters of research seminar work if they don't take the MA the written thesis option. So in a sense, we've moved back a bit.
Yeah.
That was one of the aspects of the program that Merle Jensen opposed also. He saw that, and I think correctly, as a relaxing of standards. Well, that's the type of changes in the department that really did cause hard feelings, I guess. I was, I guess, again, rather insensitive to all this, and I never really realized how deeply people could feel about even graduate programs. I never got much involved personally, it seems to me, with all of these things.
You said the other day, you spoke of certain number of people who were powerful or who were consulted when decisions had to be made, and you named some of them.
Well, maybe I shouldn't here.
Well, if you don't want to.
It's not a matter of that. It's the people, the outstanding people in one of the three caucuses, but not just the outstanding scholars. There's two requirements to be powerful in the department. One is the scholarly standing, the eminence as a historian, and the second is that one is politically active or involved, wants to take a role, and does take a role in making decisions. Combine the two, stature and political involvement, and you can identify very quickly by these two criterion who the powerful people are in any strong department.
So the scholarly stature is important to this.
I think it's, in the long run, necessary before one can retain any powerful role in a department. You lose credibility over the years if you're not a productive scholar.
Yeah.
So you have to do that side of it all as preparation. There are many people in our department through the years that have been excellent scholars. Some have left and have taken no role at all in departmental affairs.
Yeah, well, understandable.
Reluctant even to serve on committees.
But what you're saying is it can't be the opposite.
No.
Yeah.
No. We have enough people so that if people want to, I want to say cop out, but I'll say opt out of involvement in departmental affairs, they can usually get by with it, stay to themselves and do their own work, either as teachers or as scholars.
What do you think about the? Phil talked about pressure to publish. Is that something you want to talk about?
Well, yes. I don't think it's a great issue here. Certainly for a young person. I started to say young man, and I think that indicates the fact that we have not had many women in the department, my inclination to say young men. But young people in the department, of course, are under pressure to gain tenure after 6 years, and they certainly feel under pressure to publish. I suppose in all fairness, we would say that they're under pressure to commit significant scholarship, but in history that usually entails or leads to publication. By the time they're through that tenure decision, if they don't have the habits, the working habits of a scholar, and continue to be active and to publish, they will suffer other consequences. They won't get as large merit raises. But more important, their image, their sense of identity in the department will suffer. And they'll feel, at times, they'll feel that they're out of it all. Mm-hmm. So I think these informal constraints continue to operate beyond the tenure decision. So in that sense, you have to be a productive scholar to really feel at home in a department like this, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, of course. I realize everybody I talk to agrees that publishing is essential to teaching.
It's the preparation for teaching, at least in advanced courses and certainly in graduate courses. You can't be a teacher at the university level unless you're actively involved in scholarship.
We really have to do something to counteract that myth, don't we?
Well, I suppose we fight it because
the public certainly feels that it's either or.
And that they're in opposition.
Yeah.
They have an image, though, of teaching that bothers me all the time. I talked about this the other day. I think they think of a great teacher as a warm and generous person, open to students, to their academic or even their personal problems, willing to consult with them. By the way, I'm not opposed to any of this. Mm-hmm. They see them as a father figure, a counselor, and then in the classroom, someone who can entertain, amuse, inspire students, and make a subject interesting to them. Well, that's all, again, an asset in a teacher, but I keep emphasizing that our role, in a university at least, is to bring the student into confrontation with the frontiers of a discipline, with the latest findings and with the most rigorous type of knowledge a field has to offer. And only people very active in a field, who are themselves doing research, working at the frontier, are conversant continuously with those who are, can bring the type of information to students that they deserve when they pay their tuition in a major university.
Now this is true for freshmen too, freshmen and sophomores?
Well, I think even there, the integrity of what they receive, even in a survey course. Admittedly, it cannot be as rigorous or as subtle or as carefully developed as in an advanced course. But it can be downright wrong. It can be 10 years out of date or even 20 years out of date. It can mislead. It can reinforce old mistakes that they picked up in out-of-date high school courses. And again, the students won't be aware of it, and what they perceive as a brilliant teacher may be the one that reinforces a mistaken understanding of the past. Yes, even in a survey course, I think it's necessary for the people teaching. They can't be themselves a scholar on all the subjects they have to cover, but they can be a scholar in some of the subjects they cover, and they can work closely with and have some of the rigorous standings that go with scholarship in all the fields that they touch upon in a course. I would say even in a survey course, yes.
But how do you enforce that if you know one of your colleagues is, or do you not know it?
Oh, I know it.
I don't even have to wait
for your question. I know from all types of comments of students, things I pick up, that some of my colleagues don't maintain as great a rigor in the content of their course as I would like.
But there's nothing you can do about it?
No, not really.
Do you find that shocking? I mean, if this happened in the medical profession, we'd all be horrified.
No, it happens in the medical
it does
profession
happen,
all
of course,
the time.
But I mean,
I'm not sure it's any different at all there. Talk to any nurse about the shortcuts that physicians take and often the failures they make that they have to cover up for all the time.
But they do make some at least lip service to peer review and...
We have peer review and we have student evaluation both. And it does screen out the worst performance, probably as effective as the different informal processes screen out totally incapable physicians. Mm. In fact, I suspect even better than in the case of physicians. There's probably not as many techniques of self-protection built into the teaching game as there is into medicine.
Yeah, but you can't fire the guy if he's on tenure.
Well, now, lapses in teaching of certain types can even lead to firing.
Oh, well, the gross ones, yes.
Gross ones. And there are problems of judgment and personal evaluation. The person I am unhappy with in their teaching may be pleasing another of my colleagues who has equally high standards, but our perceptions simply vary. I don't think we have much bad teaching in the department. I have been more concerned not with the content of courses perhaps as much as what I thought were a little too loose standards in grading.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did talk about that the other day.
I've been unhappy when colleagues have assigned B grades to students that I did not think deserved more than a C grade. Mm. And I've been a little unhappy with TAs often, because again, often my unhappiness comes from TAs and not necessarily from the lecturing professor. I've been unhappy that in some of the courses we have not assigned enough writing, or in the evaluation of students' writings we have not been rigorous enough. Because I've had students come into my courses and turn in what they thought an acceptable paper, and they swear that it had been acceptable, the TA they had the year before, and I find it's an F paper. Suddenly I'm imposing standards that they have not confronted before. That's what I mean
by my
dissatisfaction.
I know that you wrote a paper on student evaluation, and I'll put that in your file to go with this tape. It was I realized it was one of the things that you practiced writing on. I could imagine you going into the office and saying, "What shall I write today?"
No.
It was a very fine statement.
I was very much involved, personally involved. It's a type of polemical writing, very similar to dashing a letter off to the newspaper on something that you're very concerned about. I don't think it was something I wrote because it was my assignment.
No, I'm joking.
I did put a lot of effort into the wording of the statement.
It was very clearly worked out, I thought.
There's an aftermath to that. As a consequence of doing that, I was placed on a committee to develop, after all the decision we did make, or actually the university made it for us, that practically mandated from the regents that we have some type of student evaluation. Mm. So it became less and less a matter of history department policy and a matter of university policy. So I eventually served on the committee that drafted our official departmental questionnaire for handing out to students, and defended the questionnaire in a department meeting, even as at the same time I continued to reaffirm that policy statement I made earlier, pointing out the dangers of the whole process of student evaluation. So I was involved on both ends. I opposed the policy, but once the policy was accepted, I was involved in working out what I thought was as clear and precise a questionnaire as possible.
And are you pleased with the one that exists now?
I'm very pleased with the questionnaire.
Oh, I think we're in it.
But they were not prints that I would consider of the high and subtle aesthetic quality that you have in an artist who is first an artist and then works in printmaking, mm-hmm. because the medium has a potential for the kind of artistic statement as well as his subject matter that he wants to make. So Currier and Ives, if you're talking about a commercial enterprise that was setting down in lithographs images of 19th century America, then they're fine social documents.
Happy with the student evaluation process and the way we use it in the department, we didn't mandate that professors turn in evaluations for all their courses. We hedged a bit and made it imperative or necessary or obligatory, I believe, once every 2 years they turn in evaluations for a course. I think you can already sense that they're going to carefully pick the evaluation forms that they turn in if they don't do it as a common practice. I think it would be fair if we're going to use evaluations to simply require everyone to use them all the time, mm-hmm. if we're going to do it. I was also concerned that professors not administer the evaluations themselves. But it's,
yes.
And it is an option now. The last time I used them, I had the undergraduate advisor, I believe, simply take over my course and administer evaluations and collect them because I didn't want to have anything to do with the process. But that's not generally true, although some do that. In most cases, the professor, probably after the best lecture they have in the whole semester, pass out the evaluation forms. And I think they can even, in part, control the situation or the atmosphere in which they're passed out. It doesn't take much. In fact, the form itself makes clear that for non-tenured staff, at least, these are now mandated to be part of the tenure review process. So students may feel a little bit under constraint when they fill out the forms, recognizing how important it is. It's like giving grades for someone who's going to be drafted for the war in Vietnam. It may affect the process. I would be happier, in fact, if the whole evaluation process were carried out by a student organization, and that the only role of the faculty in this case would be to release a portion of a class period for the purpose of evaluation.
Have you suggested this?
Oh, I have all along. Many other universities have had a strong student evaluation program for years. In fact, the students initiated it way back before faculty members ever thought about it, at Harvard, for example, and they have course guides that they publish each year. That, I think, is by far the best way of carrying out evaluation.
Why wasn't it adopted here?
There was not apparently enough student interest to do the work. It's a lot of work for students, and they have to have a strong committee and a little bit of financial support to really carry out and publish each year their evaluation of professors. The reason I think students should do it does seem to me that it's primarily from the perspective of students that we get the evaluation, and they're making their decisions and recommendations to other students based upon criteria that I don't accept often, but nonetheless, it's their business. In a sense, it's a type of consumer work. Mm-hmm. As consumers, mm-hmm. they have a right to evaluate the product. As mm-hmm. one who is trying to give the service to the best of my ability, I don't always agree with their standards. For example, I can remember when I first came here, the Wisconsin Student Association did occasionally conduct evaluations through questionnaires in some of the survey courses. And I can remember how upset I was to find all types of educational policy written into the questionnaire. For example, you receive brownie points for being responsive to student questions. for having a lot of discussion in a course. Well, discussion can be educationally effective, but I think it often is not. And it's already, in a sense, mandating objectives for a course to suggest that it's good to have a discussion or to always stop a lecture and hear a question. You see how educational policy gets built into a questionnaire. Well, I remember being unhappy with those. One of them was accessibility of faculty to a professor. And I remember I was amused
to
at
students,
one, to students, mm-hmm. for students to come see them. I remember it was then when I was over on Charter Street in a house. For 2 years we didn't have an office, and this building was not completed. Well, since I came to Wisconsin, I have not had office hours. I tell students that I'm here from 8 to 5 usually, and any time they want to drop in, come ahead. Mm-hmm. That my office hours are all the time, and I give them my teaching schedule and tell them any time except when I'm teaching, I'm open to them. That, I don't know how one could be more open.
No.
But they had difficulty finding that house over on Charter Street, and I had very few students ever come to see me there. So on the accessibility of the faculty members to students, I got a very low mark.
That's unfair.
So the students, perhaps from their perspective, quite rightly felt that they could not find me. Almost all history professors were up in Bascom, and they dutifully go up to Bascom, look for my office, even though I told them where it was. And then they'd tell them it was off on Charter Street, and they didn't know where that was, and most of them never went to the extra effort to make it over to my office.
So literally you were inaccessible, but that wasn't the purpose at all.
Well, that's how a student questionnaire can be very misleading. Mm. My concern is that in our evaluation, our collegial evaluation for different purposes in a department, whether tenure decisions, promotion, or even salary, that we take student evaluations as only one of many factors. And take account of all the problems of student evaluations. I think they're indicative and useful. I'm not at all suggesting they're not useful. I think often they can identify real problems in teaching. And at times they can also indicate, I think, great achievement on the part of teachers, and we should take that into account. But I wouldn't go too far with student evaluations. Personally, I would rather have a few marked exams and papers in order to see two things, the type of exam a professor offers and the type of evaluation and criticism he gives back, as well as grading standards to the student, than to have an evaluation by students.
Yeah, I can see that. That would be, but your adjustment of the professor would certainly be, oh, here he goes.
I guess he stopped for lunch for a little bit. What is that?
Well, let's try it with it in the background, see what happens. It may be, if you get a little closer to the to the mic, let me drown it out. That's all right.
Well, I had earlier suggested that I, as a faculty observer at least, I was fascinated with the problems of power in the university, who makes decisions and how they make them. Now, I'm sure that perceptions are very different from people who are in administrative roles, deans, for example. They're at the real center. But my observation in a university such as Wisconsin, a large and prestigious university, is that a lot of the decisions are made informally at departmental level, and that the critical people are those few, perhaps 10 or 12% of outstanding faculty members, those with national reputation or who stand high in their own discipline, in the departments, that they can effectively frustrate or impede the implementation even of policies made at the central administration level. They know their own field. They have their own standards, often very, very conservative standards that they apply in hiring and promoting and determining curriculum. They generally have to follow certain directives from the center, but even then, I think in most cases they can make those directives work the way they want. So in a sense, I suspect that the real power of a university is hidden. It's not formally recognized. It's not in officials as such, but in major, well-placed faculty members. That's been my observation here. I've often felt sorry for deans, because I think often people who do become deans in the academic areas are idealist, even utopian. They have their own ideals about what is possible in higher education, and they often try to implement very innovative programs. It's our business to think them up. And I think they're constantly frustrated in some of their goals by what happens in the oligarchies back in the departments.
Can you give me an example? And do you think this is a works to the good of the university or the bad or both?
Well, both. Let me answer that one.
All right.
It, of course, when one talks about what's good for the university or bad for the university, you have to identify your own perspective and also your own preferences, ultimately even moral preferences that allow you to make such judgments in the first place. It's easy for faculty members to identify the good of the university with what's good for faculty members. We're all self-serving, and I'm not at all inclined to believe that faculty members are less self-serving than people in any other profession. Maybe I simply am more aware of their self-serving proclivities than people in other professions. I wouldn't say they're worse than others, but I think they're probably as self-serving as ministers or preachers are, for example, and I think they're very self-serving too. We often easily circumvent questions about what's good for the university into questions about what's good for the department, for our discipline, or for ourselves. And looking at it from that standpoint, we're often terribly dissatisfied with decisions made in central administration, and beyond that, political decisions made by the people of the state through the legislature. I often try, it's hard, to step back a bit and view things, for example, from the perspective of the taxpaying citizens of Wisconsin and what they're paying for and what they're not paying for at times. And when I look at it in my capacity as a taxpayer, I'm often very distressed too, because I know some of the inefficiencies of the university and how easily money is simply wasted here. And I recognize for faculty that university teaching can totally involve them, and they put in an enormous amount of hours, but in the same way, because of the looseness of the system, some people can get by with very little. It's both an opportunity for extra work, but it's also an opportunity for many to get by with probably not more than 20 hours of effective university work each week, and it depends.
Do you have any idea what percentage that would be?
It's hard to know. It's really hard to know. I don't have any colleagues, I think, that are completely lazing off. And it's hard for me to even know then, because what happens when they're working at home, for example? Yeah. Who knows? But I know enough examples and enough rumors of examples from other departments to know that some people, tenured, simply don't put many hours in to the university. Yeah. I'm convinced that they don't, not effectively anyway, and they get by with it. There's very little way we can do anything about it. So there is a lot of goofing off in university, and at all levels. It's easier for us to get new staff, it often seems, than new faculty members through the classified employee system. We have an abundance of secretaries in the department. There are very few in the country that have as many. That is, we probably have one secretary for every two or three faculty members, which is a very high administrative load for our department. It's very pleasant for us. We can usually quickly get a letter typed, or even in the summer, all of our manuscripts typed, because secretaries are literally listening to the radio and twiddling their thumbs during part of the summer. Now, during exam weeks, they're all very busy. I don't want to.
Yeah.
And they much prefer to be working as to twiddling their thumbs.
Well,
so I'm not saying a word about the secretaries. Mm-hmm. But we have plenty. And it's easy to abuse the system, to either have too many, to ask for too many, are to end up having them do little tasks that we could almost as quickly do ourselves. But there, I don't think there's great concern. Just as it's always easier to get buildings for a campus than anything else, it seems easier often to get classified work than it is to get a well-placed faculty member.
You could get one faculty member for two secretaries,
right,
practically.
Mm. So to come back to your original question, is the entrenched power of well-placed faculty members in departments good or bad? I think at times they protect the integrity of a discipline. At times they protect very high standards, particularly in recruiting or promoting faculty members. The self-policing function does take place very effectively. And in their opposition to all types of new-fangled innovations in curriculum or programs, they often turn out in the end to have been wiser than the utopian administrators who were trying to push some new fad. And often we get fads and fashions coming, often through political pressure, out of central administration. In those protective ways, I think the faculty oligarchy works well. But in other cases, they can impede and block what, in retrospect, I would judge to have been needed innovations in the university. I think this is typical of conserving groups anywhere in society. They often protect, but at times they endanger progress because they won't let things happen.
So from your point of view, the administration is not so as important as we tend to think it is.
Well, in a university as large as this, a lot of decisions have to be made at a central place. We're very fragmented and very decentralized, and in part that means strong oligarchies, but at the same time, it means that individuals in departments can't keep their hand on the whole university and what's going on at the center. So a lot of administrative work, paperwork, and so on has to come from the center. But generally speaking, and I think certainly this would be the perspective of taxpayers, the university has one function, and that's to teach students and to bring to the teaching task new knowledge, which is the research function. That's its role. And the payoff is in the quality of the knowledge and in the effectiveness of the educational process. The payoff is in students, whether the students be here in the university or out in the larger world. So a university is for students of all ages. Faculty, to that extent, are servants of students. And because of the necessities of operating a large university, there has to be a lot of housekeeping details. Administrators from the deans on up or down are the servants of both faculty and students. They're in the servant role, they're necessary, but they're not essential to the function of the university except in this subordinate role. In that sense, I suppose I'm putting them down.
Well, there's been this the tendency to say that since the 60s, the administration runs the university and the faculty no longer have you don't think that's really
well,
happened?
Well, no. I think that many young professors can be very resentful here. They correctly perceive that they have very little to do with running the university, and faculty governance and all that junk turns out to be largely mythology as far as the majority of faculty. They keep noting the people who are in major committees or on the university committee are part of the old guard, people who've been here 20 years, who know each other, who are part of a comfortable little club. Mutual acquaintances, the old boys network, whatever you want to call it. That's true, and they're correct. They don't have, unless they fight for it, and in some cases young faculty fight very effectively, and by being loud enough, long enough, they can be heard. In fact, they become part of the old boy network very more quickly by fighting for it.
Yeah.
But unless they take extra effort, the informal sources of power pass them by all the time, and they're quite aware of that. Things literally, and put it in the passive, things are being decided all the time, and they don't really have a sense at all of how they're decided.
And how they are decided is the few influential people in the department.
It's a very complex way, but it involves all types of informal avenues.
Yeah.
Often the people who are making the decisions in no sense are aware or in any intent at all of trying to monopolize power. They're open, generous people who would insist that every faculty member should have input into the process. There's no intent and there's no conspiracy at the center. And I think often it's very disarming for even the young person who's fighting for power to suddenly in a few years find himself literally part of the system without realizing, and suddenly realize that other people coming in now will view him as he heretofore viewed the people who've been here longer.
You know what's amusing me suddenly is you had said that you don't think much of the social sciences.
Now, don't put it that way. I don't think much about them because my own interests have not taken me much into the social sciences. I'm not, don't say I don't think much of the social sciences. My affinities as an intellectual have been more in other fields.
Yes, okay. I guess I won't go into that, but I'm just going to comment that this is something that sociology goes into very much, this business of how decisions are made.
Right.
And do you want to say more on that?
Well, you've...
I didn't mean to cut you off.
It's even hard for me now, and I've been working with this a great deal, because I've been concerned with philosophy of inquiry generally, and philosophy of history in particular is one branch of empirical inquiry. And inevitably, that raises some of the problems of the so-called social sciences. I have great difficulty now clearly identifying which disciplines are social sciences and what it means to be a social scientist. And that's to get into a thorny issue for philosophers. Mm-hmm. So my references to social scientists are very fuzzy to begin with. I don't know really who I'm talking about when I say social scientist. We have a department here called political science, perhaps a bit of a pretentious title, but nonetheless that's the title of a department. But in the department we have people teaching courses on administration, public administration, on comparative governments, on the history of political theory of a normative sort. And it's quite clear to me that very little in the work of those people would qualify properly as part of a generalizing science. Yet, by university categories, those people are part of one of the social sciences. In fact, in a rigorous sense of the word scientist, I doubt if many people in sociology or political science, or even, and it'd be less true, but even in economics, are strictly speaking trying to work on generalizable theory of any sort, truly universal theory of any sort. And to the extent that they are, it comes into their work only marginally. So perhaps to that extent, we don't have any social scientist in the very hardest sense of the word. I could eliminate them. My own affinities, my work in, or my concern with history of religion, for example, work in intellectual history generally, I think I have more affinities with people in anthropology, but that's begging whether one ought to classify anthropology as a social science or not. And it depends on the definition, and it's not my concern to tell them whether they're a social science or something else. But if it is a social science, then I think that I do have certain affinities with people in anthropology. But that's not surprising, because their subject is man or acculturated mankind, and historians are concerned with acculturated mankind too.
Well, you said you were disappointed at the lack of relationship between the history department and the philosophy department, and surprised at the very close connection with the social sciences.
Well, not surprised. It's traditionally the social sciences, however we define them, but departments with that label, economics, political science, have been very strong. Sociology, one of the stronger departments at Wisconsin. So when I came here, I was not surprised to find that historians, in a very strong department too, had developed working relationships, cross-listed courses, mutual programs with the social sciences here. No, I wasn't surprised. I do lament the fact that we have not established as many institutional ties with the humanities. And I don't want to in any way suggest that it's their fault. I think often the humanities have not been as strong at Wisconsin, and that may be part of the explanation. And maybe the historians that have been at Wisconsin have not had or have not felt that they had as many affinities with people in the humanities, and therefore the contacts have not developed as strongly. We don't have as many cross-listed courses, for example, with philosophy as we do with economics. And one other thing I did point out before, one of the major humanities is simply absent. It's not here at Wisconsin. We have never had any program in religious studies. Now, we have courses spread all around, but no program, no staff, no department. And since I am increasingly interested in the history of at least varieties of Christianity, I don't have any department I can go to find outside support for that subject. Not only are the humanities therefore a bit weaker, but we don't even have the whole spectrum of humanities in our curriculum.
And has this not ever come up? Has it been proposed?
Right. We've done a lot, and I've been on a committee myself, an informal committee, in part instigated by people outside the university, chaplains and the different religious organizations. We have now for the first time an embryonic program in religious studies with one course and a program involving other listed courses in several departments that do touch upon different world religions. So we're moving. As I leave, we're moving toward not a department, I think, but at least a somewhat coherent program in the field of religious studies. One of the weakest areas in our libraries is in this area, for example, in part because there's been no one here to take an interest in acquisitions in that area.
It seems rather awful comical to me that a major university should be weak in the humanities.
Well, it's not at all now. We have some very strong language departments.
That's true.
I don't want to dismiss all the humanities at Wisconsin, far from it. What I do believe, though, is that if you take the major identified social sciences and take those departments and their reputation and standing nationally and compare them with the humanities, beginning with the English department, that as a whole, the social sciences are going to come out a good bit stronger than the humanities.
That's all. Do you think Worf has any, the support that Worf has given, has anything to do with this?
No, not now. Of course, originally Worf's support was primarily for the physical sciences, and then they expanded it until it encompasses almost anyone today.
It's
technically,
a very, very small proportion of the humanities.
Right. The humanities don't easily come under Worf funds. History does, because we classify as a social science, and they expanded it to encompass the social sciences. There aren't as many research funds available in the humanities, and in many cases, of course, research is not the right word for the type of work they're doing in the humanities. It depends upon what field. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's many funds available, usually. Jobs are very scarce in some key departments. Philosophy, I understand now, is very hard put to place their students. Possibly worse off in history. And I would myself classify most of the work that historians do as humanistic. It does seem to me that they're almost always, perhaps invariably, concerned with culturally conditioned human behavior. And thus, they have to be concerned with how much this behavior varies from one cultural context to another and through time. And to the extent that they're interested in what is distinctive to man, that which is conditioned by language, by symbolic systems, they would automatically classify as being humanistic in orientation. That is, their discipline is humanistic. And that is totally apart from the research tools they use. The fact that one counts along the way does not to make one a social scientist.
Yeah.
Everyone has to count. The fact that you process data or store it on a computer and use computations from it are even enormously refined statistical techniques to make inferences from mass data. That in no sense helps distinguish whether you're a humanist or a generalizing scientist. It's the content of the discipline and the purpose of the inquiry that determines that, not the method you use. This only indicates that silly distinctions such as quantitative historians or social science history are linguistically absurd if you look at them closely.
They can't help being humanists.
Well, not if
really.
They're concerned with culturally conditioned human behavior, and as far as I know, all my colleagues are.
Yeah.
Now, there are natural historians. Your husband, in fact, has introduced a course that probably bridges between natural history of mankind. That is, when you do not even have available cultural artifacts, and you're then looking to the what we call prehistory of mankind, when we don't have cultural artifacts or very few, then you're probably working in an area of natural history, which would be comparable to doing a history of the wolf, for example. You're looking to the development of an organism through time. But you don't understand the meaning system. Perhaps for the wolf there is none, and for prehistoric man he hasn't left enough artifacts around that allow us to infer what it was. We know he had symbolic language because of certain artifacts, but we can't infer the meaning content. Natural history is a field of history, but I don't find many of my colleagues at least involved in natural history.
Mm-hmm.
The people in the physical sciences are often.
Have you got something else?